I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Congress and the president may be on vacation, but that hasn't stopped news about politics or international crises, most notably the growing violence in Egypt. Republicans have been hearing from constituents at town hall meetings angry about the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare. Meanwhile, there are deep conflicts within the GOP between the conservatives allied with the Tea Party and the leadership. Democrats have been distancing themselves from Anthony Weiner, still running for mayor of New York City, and San Diego Mayor Bob Filner, who is blaming the city for not giving him anti-sexual harassment training. There are more revelations about violations by the National Security Agency, and whether you like it or not, it's clear the next presidential campaign has begun. We have two guests who have joined us in this hour of Radio Times, and joining us from the NPR Bureau in Washington is Robert Costa, the Washington editor for National Review, a political analyst for CNBC. His blog, The Corner, is found at nationalreview.com. And Bob Costa, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, good morning. It's great to join you.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us, Dick Pullman writes the National Interest blog at the NewsWorks website here at WHYY, also a full-time faculty at the University of Pennsylvania as writer-in-residence. And Dick Pullman, nice to have you with us once again on Radio Times as well.
Good morning, Marty.
Bob, let me begin with you and actually begin with some of what you have been writing about in National Review, having to do with not just a deep split within the GOP, but talk about a government shutdown. Help us understand what the fight is about within the GOP.
Sure. Like everything in Washington these days with divided government, it's complicated. But here's it in brief. In September and October, the continuing resolution to fund the government is set to expire. And this is – many conservative Republicans are looking at this as an opportunity to try to go right at the president's signature law, Obamacare, and try to defund it. But of course, this is not something that can really happen in divided government with a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president. And so the real tension right now within the GOP is how to handle this government funding. Should you try to push for a government shutdown to make a statement on Obamacare, or should you just pass a CR to fund the government and pick a different battle?
Where does that leave Boehner? Is he in the middle of this? a snicker from you, Bob Costa. Where does that leave Boehner?
Like usual, the speaker is in a corner under fire. John Boehner, ever really since the election, since he took the gavel once again in January of this year, has struggled to control his conference. It's almost impossible to keep his right flank under wraps, in line, trying to do something as a united party. And so I think what he's really trying to do, it's the old phrase in Washington, herding cats, and it's a difficult task.
But is it they don't respect him, they don't fear him, they don't follow his direction?
Well, there's nothing he can really do except try to make an argument to them. The era of earmarks is over, and so the real power center right now is not in the speaker's office, but in the outside conservative groups, the Tea Party activists. Those are the donors and volunteers who really matter to a lot of these conservative politicians. So when it comes to the question of whether to shut down the government, I don't think they're really listening to Speaker Boehner. They're listening to the conservatives out in the fields.
And to you, Dick, what are the political risks of threatening or even shutting down the government?
Well, I think the Republican establishment, I guess you could call it, or the more sort of mainstreamish legislators in Washington, have been making the case in the last few weeks, saying that let's remember what happened the last time we decided to go to the brink. You know, they're citing 1995 and getting blamed for the government shutdown under Clinton. And so there, you know, there's a tension here, framing it a little bit different from what Bob said, but similarly, between sort of taking a stand and governing. Governing requires half a loaf. Taking a stand rhetorically is 100% of the loaf. And I think we've seen some of the tension in some of these town halls that have taken place in the last few weeks, where some lawmakers have stood up and said, Republican lawmakers have stood up and basically said, look, you know, like you were saying, like Bob was saying, you can't shut down the government over Obamacare because you have a Democratic president and Democratic Senate. But you have people in the audience standing up and saying, we elected you and people like you to stand up for conservative principles. And so what happens when the principles are potentially clashing with the governing?
Well, Bob, let me just quote something. This is something that Newt Gingrich said earlier this year. I'm sure you're aware of it. I'll just read a bit of what he said. He was talking to Republicans saying, I will bet you, for most of you, you go home in the next 2 weeks when your members of Congress are home, and you will look them in the eye, and you will say, what is your positive replacement for Obamacare? And they will have a zero answer. He's basically saying to the Republicans, you don't have an answer to what to do if you get rid of Obamacare.
You know, Speaker Gingrich, he has had a complicated political life, but his comments recently at the Republican National Committee meeting in Boston, I think, are spot on, because the party right now in Washington and elsewhere is struggling to come up with a message that's something beyond being anti-Obama, being against the president, almost being a negative party, an opposition party. And the challenge for the Republicans right now is, instead of just being an opposition party, can they be an alternative party? Mm. And Gingrich is right. Can anyone out there really articulate the Republican alternative on health care? Not really. They're almost obsessed and immersed in this world of conservative politics that's about shut down mm-hmm. and brutal frontal assaults on the administration.
But do you think, Bob, is that the critics of Obamacare, as it is called, are afraid it's going to work or afraid it's not going to work?
It's mixed. There's a sense that there is some palpable fear behind the scenes on the right that once the president's signature law gets implemented, that people will actually maybe start to like it, and that could be a real political problem for the Republicans. But most conservatives really believe that the law itself is not going to be a success once it's implemented. They look at the employer mandate delay, and they say that's a sign of trouble to come. And so instead of perhaps shutting down the government, what I'm hearing is that Republicans may try to push for a delay of the individual mandate, delay of other provisions, maybe attach it not only to a shutdown, but maybe to a debt limit fight later this year.
Dick, why do you think we're still fighting about, or the country, or certainly parts of the country still fighting about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, passed by Congress, upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court? Obama won re-election. The House, I think, has voted to defund it something like 40 times. Mm-hmm. Why do you think this is such a fraught issue?
Well, I think I think there is a strain in the culture, among many strains, Americans don't like to be told what to do. And I think certainly on the right, at least in terms of Obamacare, the idea that you have to go out and participate in this program, you have to buy insurance, you have to be sort of part of this kind of communitarian philosophy, as it were, just rubs people the wrong way. You know, they want the freedom to decline, to not participate. And so I think it runs against, their basic sensibility. But I think Bob is right in the sense that also part of the thinking is that, you know, if this takes off, a la Social Security taking off or Medicare taking off, you know, two programs which, have become identified with the Democrats. And Social Security and Medicare certainly, Social Security in particular, helped the Democrats sort of, you know, cement a strong political momentum over a number of decades.
But you know what's so interesting about the mandate? I'll toss this first to you, Dick, and then to you, Bob, which is that the mandate, the idea of the mandate grew out of the Heritage Foundation. This was a conservative idea, and now it is, you know, morphed into this almost socialist idea.
Right, right. Well, yeah, of course, that was part of what happened. That was part of the complication for Mitt Romney during 2012 campaign, right. Was, a lot of what he said in Massachusetts, a lot of what he said when he was marketing the law when it was first signed in, I believe, 2006, where he was saying, well, that the mandate is really an issue of, you know, it's about personal responsibility, you know, and it's about not, shouldering the emergency rooms with costs and other taxpayers with costs, with health costs. You have to have responsibility to pay for your own care. So, you know, I mean, the cynical argument, I suppose, would be that, that the individual mandate was fine until Obama took it up. And that, you know, if Obama is attached to it, then it is, inherently bad.
Do you think there's some truth to that, Bob? Go ahead.
I think Dick makes an interesting point there, and it's a valid one. And because broadly speaking, the Heritage Foundation and conservatives very much were pushing for conservative healthcare policy that included a mandate in the early 1990s. But I think some of the conservative reluctance towards Obamacare and towards the mandate today is when you look at the Heritage discussion back in the 90s. It was about having a mandate for coverage of catastrophic illness rather than comprehensive health plans. And it's the comprehensive federal nature of the president's law that really irks conservatives.
So do you think coming up when everyone gets back to Washington in the fall, I mean, do you think there will be some kind of government shutdown or threatened shutdown, Bob?
No, I actually Speaker John Boehner and Majority Leader Eric Cantor and their aides have told me directly that they're not going to shut down the government. And Cantor has said that to me on the record because they know it's political suicide if Republicans do that. And remember, Boehner was around in 1995 and early 96 when Gingrich shut down the government. Boehner was one of Gingrich's right-hand men back then. And he knows what happens when you shut down the government. The press, that when the national park closes, it creates a lot of problems. And so Boehner's not looking for that. But here's what you're going to see from Republicans. They know they can't get a full defunding of the law, and they know with divided government their power is limited, but you're going to try to see them look to delay aspects of the law. Mm. And if they can maybe delay parts, maybe the conservative base will look at that as a partial victory.
What do you think about that, Dick?
Well, it's
just in terms of strategy,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, frankly, I don't know how the base is going to respond to that, if the base is going to say that's enough or not. You know, that's always the trick. Part of what Boehner's problem is, again, is satisfying the base. I think he's got, you know, one of the worst jobs in Washington. Mm. But I think more broadly, I think they've got to avoid the shutdown because if we're talking about appealing to swing voters, which I guess is, you know, the Republicans have talked a lot. There was a report by the Republican National Committee earlier this year that they've got to appeal more to the middle and to swing voters. And one of the things that swing voters, you know, broadly speaking, independents, hate the most is, you know, government gridlock and dysfunction. And so, you know, a shutdown, you know, they know. Swing voters kind of know instinctively that Democrats are the quote-unquote party of government and that Republicans broadly are the party of not government. So if you have a shutdown, people kind of know where the optics go on that, and so they have to avoid that.
But do you think there's some lessons from the sequester, which wasn't exactly a government shutdown? In fact, it wasn't, but mm-hmm. certainly, you know, there was across-the-board cuts in government spending and government programs as a, you know, sort of a mini shutdown.
Mm-hmm. Well, the sequester is also there's a really good piece in the New York Times about this morning, how talking about the sort of interlocking three plot arcs going on with the budget and the sequester is all sort of mixed in with the whole thing and is, you know, are they going to find a way to sort of reduce the bite of the sequester? And the Republicans have ideas, according to this reporting, that you know, that we're going to maybe sort of redirect some of the cuts in the sequester away from things like the Pentagon, but toward entitlement programs. But, you know, you can see kind of where that would run up against Social Security and things like that. So one other quick point I was just
going to
throw
on.
Yeah, real quick, is that I think part of the complication that the Republicans have, it's not just from the conservative media or not just from the conservative donors, but with gerrymandering and the way that the districts are now structured. So many of the Republican districts are sort of deeply red districts where the base has disproportionate voting power.
Well, we are talking about politics, the political landscape with Dick Pullman. And Bob Koss, I know you wanted to say something. Bob, I heard you inhale. We're going to take a very short break. Get back to our conversation. Also, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Give us a call. Talking politics today on the show. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing Education at PAFA invites you to join their community of artists of all ages and levels of experience this fall. Featuring classes in drawing, painting, sculpture, and printmaking, pre-college Saturday classes for high school students, and weekend master workshops with renowned artists, including Vincent Desiderio and Elizabeth Osborne. Registration is now open. Details online at pafa.edu/CE.
The WHYY Connections Festival is back with a day of free live music featuring They Might Be Giants, Ben Queller, and more. Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza at Penn's Landing. The WHYY Connections Festival is free for everyone, and WHYY members and sustainers get exclusive access to the Member Oasis tent all day long. They Might Be Giants and more Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza. For a full lineup and to register, visit whyy.org/connectionsfestival. Here, now, in the moment.
It's a fast-moving stream of news and information. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. We are co-hosts for Here and Now, your source for news, updates, and great stories.
In the middle of your day, stay on top of what's happening.
With Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Don't miss a thing.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We're talking about politics, some of the issues that continue to divide the two parties, Congress, the White House, and the country. Bob Costa joining us from NPR Studios in Washington. He's the Washington editor for National Review, a political analyst for CNBC. His blog, The Corner, is found at nationalreview.com. And Dick Pullman here with us in our Philadelphia studios. He writes for the National Interest blog at the Newswork site here at WHYY. He's also on the full-time faculty at the University of Pennsylvania, where he is writer in residence. And apparently, Bob Costa is going to be talking to Dick Pullman's students in the fall. And we're
looking forward to it.
Yeah, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY, covering a whole bunch of political issues, and we certainly would like to hear from you. Dick, Bob, you wanted to say something right before the break.
Real quick, as Speaker Boehner evaluates the fall fiscal drama that's looming ahead on the horizon, he has a lot of choices to make. And Dick brought up the sequester cuts as another potential battlefield for Republicans. And I think as Boehner looks at his options, he doesn't want to do a shutdown over Obamacare, but instead he's going to look at the sequester cuts as a way to maybe wring some concessions out of the administration, perhaps on chain CPI, a change to how Social Security is operated and calculated. And so look for Boehner to look for small entitlement reforms in exchange for maybe getting rid of the sequester. That could be a way he gets something for the conservatives. They're happy with small bore entitlement reform. And the administration's also willing to make a deal on the sequester because they want to restore some of that funding.
Where do you think that leaves President Obama, Dick? And we've been focusing largely on the Republicans. I mean, there's some clear divisions within that party. But I wonder about the Democrats and their party and also the position of Obama and even maybe some of the conflicts between Obama and some of the leadership in his party. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. I mean, I think we're I think he's well into the traditional second term blues.
You think so?
Yeah. And, you know, and you can hear it. The disappointment in his camp among Democrats, particularly liberal Democrats, particularly maybe perhaps young people who were voting in 2008 for, you know, transformational change, and perhaps were a little bit naive in that regard. But I think they kind of expected more. And he's in some ways he's sort of caught between he in his way like Boehner in his way is caught between a rock and a hard place in the sense that, you know, if he pushes too hard for, I suppose, all the sort of idealistic principles that he came in with, he's not going to get anywhere, not with the political opposition and maybe not even with conservative Democrats in his own party. But on the other hand, if he compromises too much, whatever too much is,
right,
there are people on the Democratic side, particularly liberals, you know, who think, oh, he's just caving too much to Republican obstruction. So he's got a very tough road.
And where do you think freedom of not having to run for re-election ends and lame duckness begins? You know what I mean? I mean, the idea is if you don't have to run for re-election, one would think then you're sort of freed up to perhaps do what it is that you truly believe in.
Well,
and then there's this thing called lame duck.
Yeah, he's not so much free to do what he wants to do because he can't do it. It's a divided government. But he's certainly been freed up to say whatever he wants to say. And he's certainly, you know, he's been making speeches in that regard. Recently, he's been talking about one of the things that presidents rarely talk about, which is the abiding income inequality in this country and the fact that the sluggish economic recovery has helped some at the expense of others, middle class. But then again, you know, now we're getting to the point, I think, that even among a lot of Obama supporters where they say, all right, well, he's making another speech today. And he's really good at making the speeches, you know, but what about doing something?
Sure.
You know, but what is it he can do? And he might also be hampered. He's partly hampered, I think, frankly, by the fact that, part of it maybe is just his attitude toward Capitol Hill. It's been written about, but maybe perhaps not enough. You know, he was up there for 2 or 3 years. He didn't have a real history with those folks. He didn't really talk their language. He sort of, you know, disdained the the horse trading. And, you know, if you had a president who was arguably better at negotiating all that, even in this highly partisan environment, perhaps he could have incrementally be doing a little bit better than he's doing.
How do you see it, Bob? And then we'll get to our callers.
I think the president has a lot of challenges right now. He has to first politically prepare for the 2014 midterms. If he wants to have any kind of real domestic achievements in his second term, he has to try to get back the House in 2014, or at least get close to getting back the House. I think he's also lacking a big idea. I think there's some options, though, for him on the table when it comes to immigration reform. He could maybe push a little harder, climate change. But I think one most viable option for the president is tax reform. He's expressed a willingness to go in that direction during his inauguration speech and elsewhere. And I think maybe if he tries to work with Republicans on that, he could try to have some kind of bipartisan success in a tough, almost hostile atmosphere.
Well, let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have Peter joining us from Newark, Delaware. Peter, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Great discussion as always.
Thank you so much.
My understanding is that we already have laws on the books that require hospital emergency rooms to treat any individual that shows up needing care. So if people want to remove the individual mandate in Obamacare, then simply remove the existing laws that require care to be given. You know, you can't have it both ways. You can't require services, but then not require any insurance to cover those services. I'd be curious what your guests have to say about that.
Yeah, and I mean, in many ways, that's the Hippocratic Oath that doctors take, which is to do no harm and obviously to treat anybody who needs their care. I'm looking at you, Dick Pullman. And any thoughts to Peter's comment?
Well, first of all, I think I think it would be a hard slog, at least politically, to get rid of the individual mandate, because it's kind of like, you know, it's sort of the cornerstone of the Affordable Care Act. If you get rid of that, or even if Democrats would agree to vote to get rid of that, the whole thing would unravel. So I hardly see that happening. But on the separate issue of what the caller brought up, if you did not have the individual mandate, which we have now, and so the ERs treat whoever comes in because they have to, which is our status quo, you know, who pays for that cost? Mm-hmm. You know, who picks that up? You know, we all pick that up. And so, you know, and that's the argument, is that if you spread the costs through individual mandate, you won't have that kind of disproportion.
Right. Well, and Bob, you can't get your cancer care in the ER. I mean, and there's, you know, emergencies can be dealt with in the ER, but you can't get ongoing care that way.
The caller brings up a great point, because we had this discussion, in a sense, back in early 2012 when the Supreme Court was hearing oral arguments about the constitutionality of the individual mandate. And I think one reason Republicans are pushing to delay the individual mandate is because they know the law could fall apart without it, because if you don't have the individual mandate to prod the healthy into purchasing insurance, then, of course, the whole system could crumble, or at least stumble and fall apart. And so that's a kind of political weapon Republicans want to use to get rid of the individual mandate or delay it. But I think Democrats will be very resistant to that, because it's an important part of a comprehensive federal plan.
And that's Bob Costa. He's the Washington editor for National Review, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington. Here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Dick Pullman, writes the National Interest blog on the Newsworks site here at WHYY. We're talking politics, as we have done with these two gentlemen in the past, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Why? Let me toss immigration on the table. And actually, Dick, if I can just begin with you, the Senate has moved on an immigration bill. It hasn't had much headway when it comes to what's going on in the House. Do you see some kind of consensus on immigration moving forward, taking into account the 2012 presidential election when so many Latinos voted for the president?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The Republic, I'm sure Bob can speak to this very well, and I'm sure he will. The Republicans, I think, have sort of two different time frames here. You know, one is the 2014 midterms, and one's the 2016 presidential election. If they don't move much on immigration reform, and there hasn't really been much impetus, it doesn't seem, in the last few months, although maybe they're trying to figure something out. If they don't move on it, I don't know if it would really necessarily hurt them too much in 2014. I think because, as I was saying, you know, the way a lot of these districts are structured, if we're talking about appealing to Hispanic voters, I think that would probably have minimal adverse impact in terms of holding the House. Most of those districts, I think, are sort of done in a way where, you know, the conservative base is maximized. But 2016 is another story, I think, the presidential race. One of the things that the Republican National Committee report earlier this year pointed out, and a lot of people, including myself, have pointed out, is that, you know, the burgeoning Hispanic electorate in America has already turned a number of previously reliable Republican states into either swing states or Democratic tilting states. I'm thinking Nevada, Colorado, Virginia, some that are not off the top of my head right now. Certainly California is long gone because of that. And I think the fear among many Republicans, and they've been warning about this, is that unless they do something on immigration reform and basically, you know, as a message, show some sensitivity toward Hispanic voters, that that they're going to be in trouble long term in presidential races because they have got to diversify their appeal to a wider group, to more groups of voters.
Bob, I'd be curious about how you see then Marco Rubio playing into this this whole immigration issue.
Marco Rubio was an instrumental part of passing immigration reform in the Senate. And right now, even supporters of Rubio are very pessimistic, it seems, about the chances for immigration reform. But here's why. If you support immigration reform, you should actually be slightly optimistic. Because now that the Senate has passed a bipartisan package, that's a huge obstacle already overcome. Now the pressure is on the House. What's John Boehner going to do? I think it's important that he has not held immigration votes before the August recess. And I think he's going to come back in the fall and allow some kind of piecemeal bills to come to the House floor on immigration. And this is a little inside baseball, but it's an important point. Keep an eye on the so-called conference committee. Conservatives are going to push Boehner not to go to conference with the Senate and try to come up with a consensus bipartisan bill that goes back to both chambers. But if Boehner slow walks immigration in the House forward and allows a conference to happen, that really means immigration reform could happen.
But let me ask you about Stephen King's comments. They're well known by now. He said, for every kid who's a valedictorian, there's another 100 out there. They weigh 130 pounds. They've got calves the size of cantaloupes because they're hauling 75 pounds of marijuana across the desert. He was on the Sunday talk shows earlier this weekend and stood by those comments. What kind of problem, Bob, does that create for Boehner and for some of the elders or the leaders of the GOP?
Hey, it's a major problem because it does not allow the Republicans to present a united front on immigration reform. And it's worth noting that Speaker Boehner and other members of the Republican leadership came out strongly against Congressman King's comments about cantaloupe-sized calves and this kind of thing that is a very, very much a negative, inappropriate comment towards people of Latino origin. But I don't think Steve King is the nucleus of the Republican Party in immigration. He leads many of the conservatives to get riled up about the bill and to be angry about it. But that doesn't mean Boehner's going to stop in his tracks with his own agenda just because Steve King is crowing on the sidelines.
What do you think, Dick? And then we'll get back to our callers.
Right. I mean, look, policy, you know, policy trumps all in the end. The danger, however, is that the average, say, Hispanic voter is not sort of following every twist and turn in policy. What they hear is the rhetoric. And, you know, comments like that, you know, the shorthand of it has almost a visceral impact, I think, for a lot of Hispanic voters. That just makes it sound like it just sounds like hostility. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so you know, they can tamp down Steve King, and they really need to, you know. But the danger is that when people talk that way, you know, to borrow his terminology, you know, for every one great thing Republicans do policy wise or try to do, a hundredfold adverse rhetoric like that permeates in the Hispanic community. They hear that.
Let me get, looks like Dan from South Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Dan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you.
You're welcome.
One of the deficiencies one of the guests had noted in with Obama is he doesn't necessarily have the strongest of relationships or history on Capitol Hill to pass through legislature. I know one of the virtues that, you know, Joe Biden was always contemplated bringing to the ticket was that he really did have that experience, decades worth, and those relationships to kind of act as an effective Obama administration whip And my question is, do you see him fulfilling that role in the future, and do you think he's done it effectively to date? I'll take an answer off here.
Dan, that's a great question. Let me toss that first to you, Bob Costa.
Oh, the caller brings up a great point, because if you look at the big fiscal negotiations in 2010, 11, and 12, it was not the president who brokered a deal. It was Vice President Biden. I think Biden is a secret help to the president, often behind the scenes. He's someone who can go to Congress, go to Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell, and try to cut a deal. And I actually sat down with Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, last week, and I asked him about his relationship with the president. And he looked at me, stared at me, and said very flatly in his Kentucky drawl, "It's cordial."
Cordial.
And that's
what
cordial. That's Washington speak for horrible. And so that means the president doesn't have a personal touch with a lot of legislators. And that, in fact, the biggest complaints I hear on Capitol Hill are from Democrats who don't think he reaches out enough to his own side.
And that seems to be part of the job, isn't it, Dick? To
it does. It does.
Favor.
And I agree. You know, and I'm the one who was like a caller reference who said this. I said this a little while ago. And Bob's point is good. The one thing I would sort of say, one mitigating factor, I suppose, on Obama's behalf, and is that he doesn't have, no president now has the same kind of tools and party discipline and carrots and sticks to whip these people into line like presidents did in previous generations. You know, like you, I think, Marty, I think you mentioned the word earmarks before,
yes,
or let's call it pork. You know, pork is a bad term now. The idea of giving something to somebody's district as a favor is considered, you know, odious. But that was a standard way of operating 30, 40 years ago. I mean, LBJ was, you know, famous or infamous, I suppose, for punishing, you know, people. If they did badly, he would take something out of their district or giving them something in exchange for a key vote. And, you know, presidents don't have that anymore as a weapon. So it does put more and more emphasis for them, I think, on interpersonal relations. But they don't have the kind of leverage that they had.
Bob, as Dick was talking, I'm thinking about that famous photograph of President Johnson. He's leaning over some member of Congress, and as an example of the kind of not just bully pulpit that a President Johnson had, but just the power that they seem to have to essentially call the shots.
No, that's a great point, Marty. I mean, when you read Robert Caro's book, Master of the Senate, Caro, that was called The Treatment, when Johnson would tower over someone, lean right into their face, and warn them about whether they should, how they should vote. But, you know, this is not just an Obama question. I mean, when you read histories of Jimmy Carter's presidency, Tip O'Neill used to complain that the President Carter didn't invite him over to the White House enough to play tennis, and he didn't come to the Hill enough. And Reagan had his own problems with being distant with his own party. But the second term could be, I think, a time for President Obama to almost reignite his flames. But here's the thing I don't think he's going to do, because he's always been a grassroots movement politician in a sense. His 08 campaign was about a movement, a national grassroots effort. I think he's going to try to, a lot of people criticize him for this, but keep making speeches, keep trying to stir national sentiment towards legislation rather than being someone who takes out a cigarette and has a glass of Merlot with Boehner in the Rose Garden.
And that's Bob Costa joining us from NPR in Washington. Washington editor for National Journal, Dick Pullman, with us here in our Philadelphia studios. He writes the National Interest blog on the Newsworks website here at WHYY. We're talking politics, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Dan, thanks for that call. You can call us as well, 1-888-477-WHYY. We'll be right back.
Comedian Kumail Nanjiani grew up in Karachi, Pakistan, and the plan was always for him to move to the United States for college, but he knew the states mostly from watching Ghostbusters and Beverly Hills Cop. So when he got off the plane, he had kind of a shock.
So when I went to Iowa, I sort of got off the plane kind of expecting it to be like L.A. or New York, and it really wasn't.
Karachi Boy Makes Good on the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. First things out the way, thank you for coming. Those of you who were curious and those who were maybe escorted here.
That's Bobby Cannavale as gangster Gyp Rossetti on HBO's Boardwalk Empire. Season 3 is coming out on DVD. Cannavale is also co-starring in Woody Allen's Blue Jasmine. An interview with Cannavale on the next Fresh Air.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
President Obama urges Egypt to return to peace and democracy, but the nation is reeling with hundreds dead and thousands injured.
A colleague of mine went to the makeshift morgue and he said he stopped counting the white shrouded corpses when he reached 77 and he realized he wasn't even halfway.
The BBC's Hugh Sykes evaluating the revolution in Egypt next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about some of the political issues facing the country, some of the divisions within both the Republican and the Democratic Party, some of the leadership issues as well. And again, Dick Pullman, a blogger for Newsworks, is with us, and Bob Costa, Washington editor for National Review. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Dick, I'm looking at a piece you wrote earlier this week, headline, "Mandatory Voting is a Great Idea." Now, we don't have mandatory voting in this country, nor can I imagine that we ever would. But you were trying to make a point in this piece that I'd like to talk about.
Well, sure. I mean, I brought it up in part because this is August. And
what else are you going to write about, right?
And I thought, you know, why not just sort of, you know, be a little bit on the provocative side? And I was struck by, I saw something on TV the other day, very briefly, that's in passing, saying that Australia has a national election on September 7th. And as a matter of fact, they just called the national election, and it's already, you know, within a month. So, you know, as opposed to a three-year cycle of presidential politicking. But Australia has mandatory voting and has had it since the 20s. And if you don't vote, if you don't turn up the vote, the government wants to know why. And if you don't provide an explanation, you can get fined $20, equivalent of $20, and or take you to court and fine you up to $50. And so they've had 95% turnout since the 1920s. And I was thinking, and apparently there's about 30 other countries that do this too, and about half of them have enforcement mechanisms. And I was just thinking, boy, instead of, what a great idea that would be, instead of having this, you know, where 45 or 50% of the electorate stays home on election day in America. I was thinking how great that would be if everybody actually showed up. And the point I was trying to make, and I'm not certainly not the first to make it, some political scholars have made this point, is that because we have more sort of hyper-partisanship in this country, that if everybody was voting, then the sort of the diehard partisans on the left and right would be diluted, you know, that you would have a sort of more sort of middle of the road people who don't pay close attention to politics would actually show up. They'd feel compelled to. And you would have a president elected that really would reflect more truly the will of the people instead of the will of 55% of the people.
Well, not that it's ever going to happen, Bob Costa, but I'd be curious about your thoughts.
I think Dick is right on with trying to encourage more civic involvement, to encourage more voting. I'm not so sure with the way this country's set up, with states having so much power over their own voting patterns. I mean, you have many states have mail-in voting. Other states are very reluctant to do something like that. It would just be very complicated to do it on a federal level. But it's a compelling idea. And I think the more people got engaged, probably the less partisan and nasty our politics would become.
Well, and it raises a number of things. One is that many people do not vote in this country. But it's also clear that a number of states, Bob, are instituting these voter ID laws, and certainly the critics of these voter ID laws are seeing these as impediments to voting because people have to get very, you know, specific forms of ID in order to cast their ballot.
They're right, and voting should always be something I think that people have access to, and it's a relatively easy way to go and go to the polls. But the conservative concern is always something that causes debate on the left because the left often thinks the conservative concern about voter fraud is way overcooked. But you do see instances of fraud in different states, and so that is gets the right agitated, and that's really the thing that's pulsing behind a lot of these legislative actions in different states on voter access. I don't think it's so much a partisan fight. I don't really buy into that argument so much, that Republicans are really trying to prevent Democrats from going to the polls. But I think sometimes Republicans do get quite heated on voter fraud, and it really drives their legislative agendas in these respective states.
Well, and just picking up on that, Dick, going back to you, a judge in Pennsylvania is going to decide on voter ID in this state, and that was argued before the court earlier this summer. And interestingly, the state didn't introduce any evidence of voter fraud. I mean, they were arguing on other issues.
Right.
It's if you can't find big amounts of voter fraud, then is it an issue?
Well, yeah, as I recall, I mean, a year ago, before the voter, when the voter fraud law, the voter ID law was first challenged, the state stipulated in writing, the lawyers for the state stipulated in writing that we do not have evidence of voter fraud, specifically voter impersonation fraud, which was
showing
what the ID thing was supposed to combat, that they didn't have any evidence of it. They weren't going to present any evidence of it. I would guess if there was a lot of evidence of it, then they would be, filing, you know, hundreds of pages on it.
Go ahead, Bob.
Real quick, just to kind of, as someone who reports and lives within this conservative sphere, this is what kind of drives the discussion. When you look at Philadelphia, for example, conservatives got so angry about this new Black Panther Party during the election. They looked at Philadelphia's 14th Ward and others that seemed to have zero votes for Mitt Romney, and they point to those instances and they go, oh, that has to be voter fraud. We have to do something because Mitt Romney couldn't get one vote in Philadelphia. But, of course, the reality is probably Mitt Romney didn't get one vote in some of these Philadelphia wards, but there's a suspicion that that could be voter fraud, and that creates this atmosphere of almost fear about fraud that's happening, even, mm-hmm. even if there's no evidence.
Go ahead, Dick.
We'll
get back to our calls.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Right. No, I mean, we were talking before about long-term politics and reaching out to constituencies. I think in terms, again, of the optics and the message, what the Republicans have to be careful about, I think, about these voter efforts in the various states, what their opponents would call voter suppression efforts, because it does send a message, fairly or not, it does send a message to minority voters that the Republicans are not interested in them because they're trying to impede their ability to vote. And, maybe African-Americans are not going to vote Republican anyway, but certainly Hispanic voters are part of that or should be part of that equation. And they need Hispanic voters, as a lot of Republicans, starting with Karl Rove, have been saying for years, in order to thrive as a national party.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Sean from Sea Isle City joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Sean. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
My question is how do you think the Republicans are going to have to be able to deal with the consequences of voting for the Ryan budget now that they actually had to legislate and go in committees and enact these draconian cuts that they called for? I know that a couple of committees just failed to pass bills or come to some kind of agreement. I just see it as a huge albatross around their necks trying to handle the realities of what I think Congressman Ryan's sham budget is all about.
What do you think, Bob Costa?
I actually disagree with the caller in the sense that the Ryan budget was this animating issue in the 2012 election, and Paul Ryan was hailed as this intellectual hero so much because of his entitlement reform proposal that he was put on the Republican ticket. But now that the Romney Ryan ticket lost, and you have the Democrats controlling the Senate and the White House, the Ryan budget, to assuage perhaps the caller, is effectively dead. It's not happening. It's a blueprint that's on the Republican shelf, getting dust on top of it.
Do you want to add to that, Dick? Anything you want to say? Because we got other things to talk about.
Right.
But go ahead.
What Bob said.
Okay. What Bob said. Sean, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And again, you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Dick, should we be surprised that 3 years before the next presidential election, the presidential race is underway?
No.
Is it just a perpetual 24/7, 365, every...
You know, I look at all the trips that Republicans have been making to Iowa, and I look at these political action committees that are, you know, that are just sort of, you know, metaphorically waiting outside Hillary Clinton's doorstep, you know, for her to give them a nod, and, you know, donors are you know, they're interested, and the press certainly loves to write about it, and so you have it's just, you know, it's the ongoing perfect storm, and it's just it's never going to slow down. So I think what we've got here, we are seeing early maneuvers, and we have questions that we could definitely answer, and starting with, I don't know, I'd be curious to know what Bob thinks about this. Can Chris Christie win a nomination in today's Republican Party?
Go ahead, Bob.
I think Chris Christie is the front runner for the Republican nomination. He's the only one in the field who's going to be from the Northeast, who's a two-term governor from a blue state. And he, as much as Republicans didn't like how he embraced the president during Hurricane Sandy, he doesn't have an albatross like Romney Care on his back. He doesn't have a liberal policy that really is going to put him to the center. But he can be pugnacious like Ted Cruz, but he can also have the center-right appeal and win in places like the Philadelphia suburbs. That's why I think if you're a betting person, you should bet on Chris Christie today.
And obviously, he has to get through primaries and things like that. Do you see that as a we're getting way ahead of ourselves here, but do you see that as a potential problem for him, Bob?
Oh, it's going to be a major problem for him because I think there are almost two parts of the Republican Party. There's the movement conservative aspect of the party and the center-right part of the party. I think Christie's going to wear the crown for the center-right, but he's going to have to battle someone like Ted Cruz of Texas, the freshman senator. I was just out in Iowa with Senator Cruz, and he has this almost rapturous response and reception. He's like a preacher up there on stage talking about defunding Obamacare, shutting down the government, trying to put a backbone in the Republican Party. He's going to be a challenge to Christie. And so Christie is going to have to win some conservative votes, but also push back against the right.
That would be a tough order. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, well, the movement conservatives look at, you know, they will look at his record, Christie's record, with a fine-tooth comb. And you know, I wonder what they're going to find. They're going to find things that he did. He supported some gun control stuff. And he approved, I'm trying to remember, on Obamacare, yeah, he approved getting into the Medicaid program, the Medicaid expansion piece of Obamacare. And so, you know, our movement, the question is, open-ended question really, is are movement conservatives or enough of them going to say, okay, well, he's not perfect, but we want to win next time, you know, and so will they tilt that way?
But as we know, photos live forever, and whether that photo of him and Obama on the beach, Hurricane Sandy, I mean, whether that also sort of lives on.
Well, you know, the former Republican governor of Florida, Charlie Crist, had his arm on Obama a few years ago, and he ended up getting driven out of the Republican Party, so who knows?
It was a different kind of hug, though. I mean, Charlie Crist was hugging the president.
Oh, he's hugging him.
Remember, Crist hugged the president during the stimulus debate, and that really got conservatives angry. But I think Christie's going to get some sympathy because, remember, he was hugging the president during a time of crisis in his state, and even some of the most conservative Republicans recognize that that's a unique situation.
But are we talking then about running for president as a kind of a business, which is that you've got the lobbyists, you've got these interest groups, you've got the media that, of course, loves the advertising money that helps keep everyone on the air. That this is just a business, and then you've got people like Rick Santorum, you know, running for president, or at least looking like he's running for president as well. Dick?
It is partly business. I mean, I think I was thinking of Gingrich again and his run, and I really don't know. I mean, if you had given him sodium pentothal,
interesting idea.
It is. I would pay to watch that. But anyway, in 2011, if you'd given him sodium pentothal and said, "Newt, do you think you can really win the nomination and be president?" I don't know. I doubt he'd say yes. I think what he might say under the influence was that, you know, I have books coming out. I have all these far-flung think tanks and stuff, and this is good. This is good for business. Right. You know, keeping my name out there is good for business. And I, Santorum, maybe partly in that boat. I mean, I think Santorum really does believe fervently in what he believes in. But you know, he's also a brand. You know, and this is we're all brands these days. These people are no different.
I'd be curious how you see Rand Paul, I should say, to you, Bob Costa.
Rand Paul is someone you have to really watch closely because he appeals to even liberals due to his views on national security, his more libertarian views on surveillance and going against the NSA. And so he's going to make an argument, I think he's almost 100% going to run, that he can win a new coalition for the Republican Party. He's a little more sympathetic to immigration reform, drug legalization, to stop the surveillance programs. He's not a Bush-era hawk. So he's going to try to be a fresh voice, and he's going to be someone to watch as this primary unfolds.
Did you want to add to
that? I think what's going to be fascinating is to watch, we had a little bit, perhaps a preview of Christie versus Rand Paul a couple weeks ago where they clashed on national security issues. And there is, you know, there are different groups, factions within the Republican Party about, you know, how to conduct foreign policy and how, you know, I mean, sort of Christie was sort of in the Rudy Giuliani 9/11, you know, 9/11 widows mode, and we have to be vigilant. And, you know, Peter King of New York, that congressman, is like that, too. Mm-hmm. And Rand Paul speaks more to the, you know, the national security state, and we really need to sort of trim back on that and our foreign intervention. And so, you know, it's kind of like a reaction to the old neoconservative Bush era stuff. So I think, you know, you have the potential there for, frankly, if nothing else, a very interesting dialogue on the future of the party.
Let me throw one more thing out with almost no time to talk about it. But earlier this week, Attorney General Eric Holder talking about beginning to reduce the impact of mandatory minimum sentences having to do with the drug war. And Bob, it's interesting that there are a lot of conservatives that support this idea as well. Perhaps some rare consensus on this issue?
It is, and I think you look at someone like Senator Paul of Kentucky, and Governor Christie has talked about reducing minimum drug sentences and cutting them altogether. And so I think this is going to be another thing to watch in 2016. Can Republicans change their tune a little bit on this issue?
And you know, whether people are beginning to rethink the so-called war on drugs, Dick?
Well, yeah, I was saying in a post just the other day that, you know, the old sort of tough on crime versus soft on crime rhetorical, you know, dichotomy has kind of broken down a bit. And now perhaps they're, and hey, the idea of somebody, of two sides agreeing on something would be great, that maybe they can come together on a smart on crime consensus.
And remember, real quick, in 1996, National Review's Bill Buckley went on the cover of National Review, said the war on drugs is lost. So this has been a growing undercurrent on the right for a long time.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Bob Costa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And he's the Washington editor for National Review, political analyst at CNBC. His blog, The Corner, is found at nationalreview.com. Dick Pullman, thank you very much as well.
Thanks, Marty.
And he writes the National Interest blog on the Newsworks website here at WHYY, also on the full-time faculty at the University of Pennsylvania, where he is writer in residence. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for those phone calls, and stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.